good at this time, as we are approaching a rather metaphysical phase of our subject, to try to understand a little more clearly some of the psychic motivations which led to the gradual enlargement of the interpretations of the Torah and the severe books of the Mosaic Law. As you probably realize, there are in this world many persons by nature inclined to a mystical point of view. They arise in all nations and among all religious groups and in every time of history. They constitute usually a minority. For the most part, thoughtfulness belongs to minorities. And there is only a small part of mankind that seems naturally endowed for contemplative existence. Yet such contemplation does exist. And to a measure, perhaps, it is a matter of age. Youth is not normally of contemplative mood. But the elders, after they have passed those years of immediate concern about physical things, sit together in the twilight of their age and ponder not only the world they live in, but the mysterious universe to which they shall so soon return. Thus, age is a time of contemplation. And this was more so in early days when the interests and activities of peoples were more simple and natural and less stimulated by artificial considerations. But it would not be wise merely to say that the thought of Israel was only the thought of its elders. For there are those who seem to be born of great age, and others, even in the course of years, do not achieve it. So we find among the Jewish peoples a contemplative group, perpetuating itself from generation to generation, and even though scattered by the diaspora, still continuing in their own ways, not only contributing to a mysticism in Israel, but to a measure enriching the Christian mystic and the Muslim mystic. As a result of this contemplative process, the old Jewish mind sought in Scripture not only the letter of the law, but something of its spirit. And the sufferings of early Israel probably quickened this need in the consciousness of the people. Where troubles, worries, and fears gather heavily upon a tribe, the people of that tribe seek the consolation of the Spirit. They find words are not enough, even kindly words and good words. They seek for richer meaning, for broader interpretation. Also, in the course of centuries, the letter of old law has a tendency to become obsolete. Matters which were of great interest at a certain time may lose their interest in future times. And it is not good to be in the presence of a sacred book that belongs only to the past, to ages dead and conditions no longer relevant. Yet the jots and tittles, the words and letters cannot easily be changed. But man, by his own moods, can alter the meaning to his needs. Thus interpretation comes in, enriching tradition, and in turn enriched by tradition. And in Israel, there has always been this mysticism, come down from the prophets, come down from the day when the judges judged in Israel. And Israel, of course, had a very peculiar type of spiritual teacher, a living prophet, a holy man walking with his brethren, yet divided from them because he had received the anointing power of divine insight. Thus there were prophets in Israel, men of vision, as in the story of the visions of Ezekiel and Isaiah. These visions were as of men picked up into an ecstasy, lifted up from the sorrow of the moment, whether it was the Babylonian captivity, or the long period of waiting in Egypt, or in the desert, or in the scattering under the power of the Roman Empire. Thus, this mysticism has to live. And this mysticism is not always welcome in the very place of its own birth. For mysticism always comes in conflict with the rigid dedication of orthodoxy. The mystic is always a kind of heretic. He frightens, he amazes, he even annoys those of pious mind. Therefore, mysticism is more apt to be persecuted by its own than by the stranger. And the persecution of Jewish mysticism is also recorded, though perhaps not to the same degree that early Christian mystics were persecuted. If we try to understand this situation among the Jewish people, we may see its parallel in the rise of Christianity itself. We find the early disciples under a very close relationship with the founder of their faith. And then slowly time passes. Little by little, the doings of Syria and the Roman Empire lost general interest to mankind. Mystics felt very sincerely in themselves that the human being cannot be consoled merely by history, even though it be sacred history, nor can he be redeemed by biography, even though it be the biography of a saint. The need for a continual living faith was early experienced in Christianity, which fortunately was able to provide an excellent instrument in the epistles of St. Paul. For in St. Paul, this mystical quality was already clearly manifested. And as one of the principal supporters of the early faith, Paul's position was relatively secure, though not beyond question, even to this day. But Christianity needed its mysticism through the Dark Ages, through the years of persecution, through the strange, troublous times that threatened the survival of Europe, through the Renaissance, through the dawn of the modern world, and even in our Western Hemisphere, where peoples went out into the wilderness to create homes and to carve a destiny in strange, wild places. Mysticism was therefore a continuing meaning, something which enabled the person to immediately experience beyond the ordinary teachings of his faith. Many sects have been born of mystical experiences, of visions, and of dreams. These have played their parts, for in each instance they represent a struggle away from the limitations of literalism into a world of greater emotion, of greater spiritual satisfaction than could be found in the jots and tittles of orthodoxy. So we have this experience even today, where the effort to bring Christianity into focus in our present world crisis is demanding better interpretation, deeper meaning, and the restoration of contemporary significance. These messages must be dislodged from the ancient wall of history. They must be brought directly to us to be a present help in time of trouble. So among the Arabs, likewise, who came in contact with the early Kabbalists and early Christian heretics who were cast into the desert for their mysticism. And out of these various rootings and others still older, mingling perhaps with streams of Asiatic thought, the mystical sects of the Near East found their encouragement, inspiration, and substance. So we have the dervishes and the Sufis and the Druzes. We have all these strange, melancholy poets of Arabia. We also have the deep, strange, subtle stream of East Indian metaphysics. Everywhere that faiths have come, men have been impelled by these faiths to draw something more out of themselves. And this which they drew from themselves, they assumed to be the very substance of the faith they believed. It never occurred to them to assume that the interpretations were their own. These new interpretations were the real meanings, long obscured, long hidden, long misunderstood. So, it is perfectly proper and right that the old Jewish scholars should have some concept of a mysticism, particularly necessary because of the ritualistic, formalistic austerity of their orthodox thinking. It was not enough for the elders to sit together and gravely contemplate upon the sins of Israel. It was not enough that they should constantly reiterate and re-examine the structure of the Mosaic Law. It was not enough that they should try to expand the words of the Talmud to cover every phase of human conduct. Something much more significant was needed. And that was the expansion of meaning to the consolation of spirit. These people needed the warmth of a great mystical tradition. We do not know exactly when this tradition rose in the parallel structure of the Bible. But I think it is reasonably safe to say that it was present at least 1,000 years before the beginning of the Christian era. Probably in the very early time, there was not as much need for it as later developed, but the foundations were already there, and the early students of Jewish metaphysics were convinced that their great mystical traditions descended from Moses, who had received not only the tablets of the law and the formal structure of Jewish religious jurisprudence, but had also received upon the mountain the secret and mystical instructions of God. That there was not only a doctrine for the mind, but one for the heart. Not only a revelation for the multitude, but a revelation for the few who gathered in prayerful contemplation of the great mysteries of life. By this thought, we see that another constantly jogging factor was present. Every day in his experience of this world, man learns something new. Man passes through experiences his father never experienced. And as these changes come, he must find somewhere in his faith a place for the new. If he does not, his faith soon becomes too small for him. He could not change the words, but he could ensoul them. He could discover in them this larger, deeper, and nobler meaning. He could find ways of taking obscure statements and twisting them to provide answers for situations that arose in his daily existence. These interpretations, in turn, became the basis of new orthodoxies. And the mystics themselves were revised and reformed many, many times, so that they became conservatives and liberals, reactionaries and progressives, even within the subtle structure of metaphysics itself. Perhaps one of the best summaries we can call upon to straighten this situation to the average person is by contemplating the definitions and ideas of Rabbi Maimonides upon this problem of the metaphysics in Israel. This great scholar, who was the body physician of Saladin the Magnificent, was quite convinced that, contrary to popular belief, that there was a metaphysics among the ancient Jewish people, that there was a mysticism there and always had been, inasmuch as it arose in the very consciousness of Near Eastern peoples, that this mysticism was concealed from the multitude, and that at an early time, esoteric orders and secret societies arose among the Jewish people. An admission to these was by a kind of invitation only, and only those who were the most advanced, the most comprehending, the most subtle in their thinking, the most dedicated in their lives, were ever permitted to share in what might be termed the secret doctrine of Israel. That this doctrine existed, Maimonides was fully convinced. He was not certain, however, just exactly what areas it covered. He was inclined to suspect that the mysticism of Israel was concerned first with an effort to understand the invisible universe, that part of creation which, ascending from the spheres of the known and the comprehensible into the ever more attenuated realms of the divine, was populated in its own way by angelic hosts and archangelic creatures, by mysterious beings that never appeared in our mortal world at all, and that there was some kind of a magnificent universe, far away in quality, but perhaps immanent also in value, wherein dwelt divine things, the roots, the keys, the sources, and the substances, from which illusions, shadows, forms, and mysteries are suspended into the physical world. Philo Judaeus, following the ancient mysticism of his people, found that it mingled conveniently with the mysticism of Neoplatonism and the metaphysical systems of the Orphics and the Egyptians. And he even went so far as to suspect that perhaps this mysticism of the Jewish people originated during their captivity in Egypt. Probably, however, it was older. For such mysticism was also to be found in the Valley of the Euphrates, among the ancient peoples of Assyria and Chaldea. This mysticism has always been, for there was always a poet who went out at night and sat under the stars and tried to understand life. These poets were the carriers of the mystic way, even as the troubadours, the poet musicians of medieval Europe, perpetuated the mysticism of early Christianity. Thus, with the presence of this mysticism, we come into a series of interesting symbols. Symbols that have to do with more than one quality or condition. And we must first establish the meaning of a certain bridging. Whereas in our modern way of life, especially in Western Christianity, we have been inclined to regard as God wrapped in a mystery this spiritual source of ours, I think the old Jewish rabbis were a little more courageous. Instead of considering deity to be simply inscrutable, never to be fathomed, that the laws of God and nature were beyond the understanding of man, that providence was something before which man could only bow and about which he could never question, this attitude does not seem to have prevailed so completely among these elders of Israel. They really believed that if this mystical universe of causes existed, that if region and realm extended far beyond the visible and the knowable, that their prophets were lifted up as in dream and in vision, and in some strange majesty of power, and were carried into these invisible worlds, that it was even possible for man to approach the very presence of God and return to earth alive, as Moses had done from the blazing crest of the mountain. These peoples seemed to feel that man could wander into the inscrutable regions of the divine abode, that it was possible for man, as the beloved child of heaven, to come into his Father's presence. And out of this came an interesting dual philosophy. And this philosophy centers around a symbol which I think is of value to us. And that is called the Merkaba, or Merkaba, the chariot of righteousness. This first appears, probably in fairly clear statement in the Bible, in the vision of Ezekiel. And here suddenly a strange and mysterious vehicle presents itself to our consideration. It is a strange floating thing, different from any structure man has ever conceived. It was full of wheels, and the wheels were full of eyes. And it was guarded upon its corners by the four cherubs, and their wings formed a throne. And in the midst of this strange machinery sat the Ancient of Days, a strange, mysterious being, aloof and alone. And this great chariot, accompanied by its attendants and by the hosts of heaven and by the angels and the archangels, appeared to the prophet. And after the vision had been accorded, it returned again to its own remoteness in the heavens. Many have attempted to explain the meaning of this chariot that appeared to Ezekiel. One of the most natural and proper explanations is that this strange thing with its wheels within wheels was the universe itself. That the universe indeed is a machine, a wonderful chariot, the chariot of heaven. And that in this mysterious moving universe, forever thundering along its appointed ways in space, was thrown the charioteer, the supreme power itself, riding upon creation as upon a chariot throne. This seemed to also suggest many other phases of Eastern thinking, which contributed gradually to the integration of the structure of the Kabbalah. All these wheels were worlds. These worlds were in reasonable relationships to each other. The universe was divided into levels and planes and spheres and abodes. Some of these were divine, some of them were sidereal, some were terrestrial, and others were infernal. And the universe began to take on something of the appearance of Dante's universe, a universe with its heavens and its hells, a universe the parts of which were innumerable, and all the parts inhabited by orders of creatures. And these creatures were ruled over by princes and governors and kings and rulers. And out of the good part of this universe, with all its angels and archangels, came ceremonial magic, the white magic, by means of which man was able to call upon the archangelic hosts, or the angels, or the spirits of elements, the spirits of nature and of the earth, to achieve various works and purposes which he regarded as good. And it is said that God gave unto Solomon, the king of Israel, a ring set with four precious stones, in order that he might have dominion over the four corners of creation and the four orders of beings that inhabited these realms and places in space. It is said also that Adam, coming into birth, descended through the four great worlds, receiving in each of these worlds a certain endowment, a certain part of his compound nature. And so finally he fell into the mystery of matter after having been exiled from the paradisical abode. Thus we see all of these regions and parts seem to make up a kind of machinery, a true concept of wheels within wheels, orbits within orbits, the orbits of luminaries surrounding their planets, the orbits of planets surrounding their sun, the orbits of suns surrounding cosmic suns, and so on forever, to form the great Merkaba, the chariot, the wonderful vehicle of the ever-living God, the vehicle that was full of eyes, which were stars, full of lights, full of mysteries and of laws, in the midst of which ruled the Ancient One, robed in white, symbolic of the supreme power of nature. Perhaps this thought also became involved in the vision of St. John on the Isle of Patmos, where he beheld the great being walking among the branches of the candlesticks. This concept of the Merkaba may well have inspired a great deal of research into the cosmogony of things. It also inspired another side of man's seeking, and that was the analogy that if this great universe was indeed wheels within wheels, spheres within spheres, realms that could be classified and ordered, mysteries that could be heralded into patterns and designs, so the little universe, man himself, must so likewise be constructed. And man must have also the wheels within himself, and his organs, parts, faculties, and powers were regarded as the equivalents within him of the majesty of the great chariot of the law. And in the midst of this thing which man calls his body, which is really a mystery of mysteries beyond the comprehension of even the greatest scientist of today, within this, as upon a gilded throne, rides the human spirit, guarded by the four cherubs, moving through space from an unknown origin to an unknown destiny. It was not difficult to imagine that a poetic people, living in the desert, living close to their own natural instincts, should meditate upon such matters, and should hit upon one after another multitudes of wonderful analogies, beautiful parallels, by which they were utterly convinced of the correctness of this basic assumption. And by degrees their scholars took it over. And little by little it branched out to form the basis of all of their arts and sciences. We find evidences of the mystery of the Merkaba in the structure of ancient Jewish music, of their theater, of their astronomy, their science, their medicine, their art. All of these branches of learning were enriched, inspired by these mystical overtones. Perhaps out of all of this came one of the fundamental principles of Kabbalism, the idea of the lawful universe. The universe which, although it originated in the divine nature, was still in itself a thing of law and order, a thing of causes and effects, an instrument working magnificently, following predestined courses throughout time and eternity. That this Merkaba or chariot of righteousness was indeed the total creation, synchronized, magnificently brought together without accident or coincidence, so that man lived in a universe magnificently organized, magnificently sustained and protected by the wisdom and the courage and the strength of angels and of archangels and of mysterious spiritual beings. Out of this same Kabbalism also came demonology, that witchcraft which plagued the Dark Ages. For these same Kabbalists, in many instances, discovered analogies which led them to believe that infernal forces, the dark shadows of divine beings, inhabited the lower regions of space, forming the strange peoples of some fabulous Gehenna. These evil princes and their powers of darkness could be called forth by magic and charm and invocation, as in the ancient legend of Faust invoking Mephistopheles. Thus, the universe was also full of life, life of good, life of evil, and between good and evil, some way suspended man, who must cope with both, must ascend from the lesser to the greater, must struggle against evil and struggle toward good, by all the most powerful moral and spiritual incentives which he possessed. On and on went these interpretations, and other prophets followed in the ways of the first ones, and little by little the mystery of the Merkaba took upon itself a fuller and more complete interpretation. There was a belief among the Jewish mystics and even among the more orthodox peoples that there were certain persons, certain prophets, in a certain descent from Adam, who were permitted to depart from this world without knowing death, that they were picked up in righteousness, as was Enoch, and carried into the presence of God. The angel that appeared to Moses to invite him to ascend the mountain to receive the tablets of the law told Moses to rise and follow him into the presence of God. And Moses was afraid, according to the old legends, and said that he did not dare to go, that he was not worthy to be brought into the presence of deity, and that he had no powers or faculties by which he could attain such a mystery. Whereupon the angelic being caused him to become a form of the Merkaba himself. that in some mysterious ways this wonderful chariot of righteousness was fashioned from his own substance, and in this he was allowed to ascend into the presence of the Almighty. So little Merkaba legends continue to appear, perhaps gathering some momentum in the later days of Israel, but always with something of a mystery about them. Something that was a little more, even, than the wonderful story described in the vision of Ezekiel. Gradually, we have a hint here and there that we are in the presence of a strange mystery story, the keys of which may completely elude us, but about which certain intimations can nevertheless be suspected. We are told, for example, that the mysteries of the Merkaba were mysteries not for the profane, or for the young, or for those who had not attained insight. That for the average person, the mystery of the Merkaba was a terrible and tantalizing thing that could lead only to destruction, misery, and death. So the old rabbins repeatedly warned their followers not to explore the region of this strange belief, not to seek for its true meaning, lest they discover it, and by discovering it, destroy themselves. Now, such warnings as this are rather interesting, especially in more modern times where greater audacity, if not better judgment, prevails. In this time and in this generation, and even for several centuries, therefore, research has been rather quietly but systematically carried on among students of Jewish metaphysics to see if the threads of this story could be put together into a little better pattern. Something was accomplished. In the ancient days of Israel, there were very few mystics, but these were bound together into a secret order. These secret orders were the orders of elders, chosen from among the elders, from among the wisest of Israel. These were bound by oaths and obligations, and their instruction was conferred upon them with the promise of total secrecy. Even the modern Jewish historian knows that these secret societies existed. And he also has dared to say that among the most important concerns of these secret orders was the Merkaba of righteousness. That in some way, the whole of the esoteric doctrine of Israel centered in this mystery. A mystery which even many modern Kabbalists have never heard about. And a mystery which is certainly not generally accepted or considered by modern Jews. Yet this mystery, in some way, was the very soul of the law. And this there are various Mishnahs bearing upon it. And out of the various philosophies and beliefs, we come to almost inevitable conclusions. Conclusions which are supported from outside sources to a degree, especially from among the mystics of Islam, who are known to have had contact with this earlier doctrine. Among the Muslims, we have a very interesting legend, which is part of the story of the Arabian Nights entertainment, and that is the story of the flying carpet. Now, everyone has read the story, and every once in a while it appears in some interesting cartoon or short story or fable in modern news. It's a fascinating thought, and we love to remember it, even as we love to remember the flying mantle of the little lame prince in one of our own fairy tales. Flying cloth, carpets, and robes and garments occur in many myths and legends throughout the world. But there is a direct religious implication in the flying carpet of the Arabian Nights. For it only takes one very quick look at the old reports, one moment of thought to realize that the flying carpet is the prayer rug. This is the key to the whole situation. If you have been in Muslim countries, you realize that a prayer rug and a turban are among the most important possessions of a true believer. The prayer rug is for his daily meditation, and his turban not only covers his head against the heat of the desert, but when he dies, it will be his shroud, and he will be wound in its white cloth. Thus, his turban is part of his religion, and so is his prayer rug. And at a certain prescribed hour, when the voice comes from the minaret, the faithful spread their prayer rugs to this day and, kneeling in prayer, face Mecca and recite the ancient formula of their faith, beginning with the words Allahu Akbar. Now, the prayer rug is not out of fashion, even in our day. And among the laws of Saudi Arabia at the present time are that if a man in an automobile shall come upon another man upon his prayer rug, it is his duty to stop and wait until the prayers are finished. He may not run over the man, as would be the practice in this country, nor will he be permitted to honk the man out of the way, which would be still further in our way of doing things. He must keep quiet, preferably pray also, certainly respect the entire situation, and if it takes 2 hours, wait patiently. Because some men, of course, seem to have more to pray to, others more to pray about, and still others more to ask forgiveness for, so that it is not just certain how long this prayer will take. But you will respect it. Now, in this prayer rug, what happens? When the Muslim spreads this rug, kneels upon it, it is a symbol that he has departed from this world. The prayer rug is not only a rug, the prayer rug is the symbol of the mosque. It is the symbol of the holy place. And whenever a man is upon his prayer rug, he is no longer in this world at all. He is in a world in which he faces God and God alone. There is no longer any merchandising, no longer any ties of the flesh, no longer any outside concerns whatever. He is just as much on holy ground when he kneels upon his prayer rug as he would be even if he was kneeling upon the warm pavement of Mecca. This is holiness. This is separation from all things mortal. This is departure from the flesh. And as he values his immortal soul, the Muslim will cause a wall to be built around the borders of his rug. And out from the world, nothing shall enter into that place. And while he is there, no thought of his shall turn to the world. He is alone, even though he be in a marketplace with 10,000 of his kind. In that moment, he and God only exist. Now, this is a very important concept, because we find also among the Brotherhood of Basra, one of the great esoteric orders of the Muslims, that the prayer rug became the symbol of a lodge, or a gathering place of secret orders. It was so also employed in some instances by the Druzes. For if a Druze could not attend the lodge of his order, he could be present by being upon his rug. For in that moment he joined his brethren wherever they might be throughout the world. As he stepped on to the rug, he stepped into eternity. Therefore, while of course many Muslims, no doubt, lack all this mystical overtone, it is still part of their faith and part of their orthodoxy, part of their most sincere belief. And it is a magic carpet because it carries them in an instant from wherever they may be to the very footstool of the eternal. On their rug, they can go to all parts of the spiritual universe. Their minds can contemplate upon all mysteries. They can be lifted up from the commonplace to the eternal and the inevitable. This is indeed a magic carpet, because it takes man out of this world into another world beyond. Now, there's no doubt in the world that the magic carpet of the Muslim has its origin in the Merkaba of the Kabbalah. This Merkaba, therefore, or the chariot of ecstasy, was the mysterious vehicle by which the consciousness of the devout Jewish mystic was carried from one region of space to another, ascending to the very footstool of the divine, even as Muhammad is said to have made his night journey upon the lightning flash, the strange monster called Al-Barak. In the twinkling of an eye, the prayer rug carries us throughout space. In the instant of instants, the Merkaba, as the chariot of ecstasy, carries the true believer out of the profane, out of the commonplace, into the strange world of divine realities. Now, it is obvious that there is no such a kind of vehicle that corresponds either with the prayer rug or with the Merkaba. Certainly, to all but himself, the Muslim is right where he was when he started. Certainly, there is no indication that he departed into some mysterious realm of abstract space. Therefore, the prayer rug was in a measure a symbol of departure into withinness. It was the retiring of the soul into its own eternity. On the assumption that as man went inward into himself, he also moved outward into space, and that as he found the core of his own being within himself, so he found in that same flash of enlightenment the core being at the root of all existence. The Merkava, then, must be a symbol of something like the prayer rug. And, of course, the mystic in Islam, the simple mystic, tells you that it represents only this one thing, the concentration of the mind, the internalizing of consciousness, the mysterious power to block out the irrelevant and the irreverent, and to come back into the inward abode, the secret garden of the heart. Here all the wonders of magic and mystery unfold in the soul of the believer. This again does not go very far, but it is one step towards something. And I think it is also one step toward the understanding of the Merkaba of righteousness. When we think of a vehicle, when we think of some kind of an instrument by which something can be accomplished, we are also inclined to use the term to cover the concept of a method, a means, a way. This instrument, the Merkaba, therefore, is not only a chariot, but it is a method. It is a kind of instrument by means of which miracles can be wrought. The Sufi has the same idea exactly about his prayer rug. We are moving on parallel incidents entirely. The rug itself is very often strangely designed and ornamented. One of the most common forms of ornamentation being that the design represents the open gate of a mosque. This open gate of a mosque represents an opening between worlds. It represents a door, like the gateless gate of Zen, which leads from the objective to the subjective. The same is true of the Merkaba. It is not only full of wheels and eyes, but it is also full of roads, of strange paths, the 32 paths of Sefayet Zira. It is full of winding ways that lead through the 49 mysteries of existence to the final 50th mystery, which is locked in the heart of the infinite. So that in this idea of the chariot, we also have a proper term or thought for a peculiar way of doing things. In other words, the chariot became the true symbol of the secret doctrine of Israel because it was the figure used to conceal what I have decided to call Jewish yoga. Now, there will be a lot of people, probably a good many Jewish people, who will think that this is rather far-fetched. But let us see whether it is far-fetched or not. Is there any people known in this world that has not, in the attainment of culture, developed a discipline of insight? Is there any civilized nation that has not had its mysteries, that has not had its secret disciplines for the development of contemplative life? Is there any people that have not had rules and regulations that were for the few, even as it is said in the sacred scriptures that the sword is for the Hasidim? Is it not true that the mysteries of God are for those who have sought them out or have been initiated into the rites, who have become those in whose heart, as the old work says, the fear of the Lord hath brought righteousness? Therefore, can we not pretty well assume that as we know this art existed in Egypt at the time of Moses, as we know it existed in India before the time of Moses, as we know that it has existed in the Near East ever since the contact between Islam and the Semitic tribes, is there any reason to doubt that somewhere in this strange complex of beliefs, there must have been the Near Eastern and Syrian equivalent of the common belief of all Eastern peoples? Is there also not some reason to point out that all of these allegories and legends and stories about prophets who, after certain means and methods, were picked up and carried into the divine presence, is there any way in which we can doubt that these journeys implied what we might term today religious ecstasy? That these journeys were not physical, any more than they are physical in the case of the axis of the dervishes. These experiences do not mean that a person has in the flesh departed into some other region, but that the true flesh, which is the spirit, has been raised up and the body has been left behind. This point is clearly made in connection with the apocryphal account of Muhammad and his night journey to heaven. It is reported that while Muhammad himself, standing upon the rock Moriah in Jerusalem, took hold of the lower rungs of the ladder of silken cords that descended from heaven and slowly ascended through the seven gates, that while this was happening, the prophet himself was asleep at Medina and was there seen by many persons. Muhammad never declared that he had been in Jerusalem in the flesh, but rather that he had been carried there upon a mysterious steed composed of seven animals, Al-Barak, which again represents to most esoteric students a symbol of a secret methodology, the magic of conscious projection, the mystery of controlling the relationship between the body and the consciousness. It would appear from all that we can study, even on Gnosticism, Neoplatonism, and even Pythagoreanism and Platonism in their proper forms, that a religion by means of which there is no esoteric achievement possible cannot long endure. A religion of theory alone, a religion which does not advance step by step until it ends in the spiritual experience of the presence of God, cannot truly be a great religion or an enduring one. Now, the old Jewish writers themselves have loaded this subject with warnings that only the pure of heart, only those most dedicated, only those most wise, only those most courageous must approach the mystery of the Merkabah. This is exactly the recommendation and warning that is given to the students of Yoga and Vedanta. This is the ancient burden of testimony of the Kala Chakra and the great tantric schools of India. Only those who are pure of heart may see God. Only those in whom a great achievement of spiritual integrity has already been accomplished must practice the mysteries of the Merkabah. For all others, this will lead to self-destruction, which is no more nor less than an actual statement of the warnings attendant upon the practice of esoteric disciplines. I think we can, without question, particularly by reference to the Kabbalah and its meditative principles, come to the conclusion that the Jewish mystics were perfectly aware of what we may term yogic practice. That under one way or another, under one name or another, they were conscious of this mysterious constitution of man with its mysterious gangliated structure, by means of which, through meditation, the consciousness of the individual could gradually be extricated from the complex of matter and be capable of an experience or existence in itself, attended by those extensions of faculties which may normally be expected under such conditions. The visions of the Jewish prophets and seers all tell this same story, and all would indicate definitely that the so-called anointing of the prophet also included an instruction in which a predecessor accepted this prophet into his own life, conveyed to him the mystery of the Merkaba, which is the same mystery that was transmitted in medieval times to the alchemists under the mysterious formulas of chemistry. Therefore, that the actual secret doctrine in Israel is the same as in any other part of the world, a doctrine relating to the power of lifting up man as a spiritual being and giving him the internal experience of unity with divine truth. As we go on examining the various writings and so on, we cannot but feel that this is very clearly intimated. And this brings us to another phase of our problem, which I think also has a direct bearing upon this. Namely, what we may know about meditational and prayerful doctrines among the Jewish people. We know, for example, that in antiquity it was common to divide knowledge either into two sections or into three. Most anciently, the division was twofold, what might be termed the outer knowledge and the inner knowledge. In a later time, the knowledge was considered as threefold, consisting of an outer knowledge, an intermediate knowledge, and an inner knowledge. The outer knowledge in Israel was called the Torah. The intermediate knowledge was called the Mishnah. The inner knowledge was called the Kabbalah. And the Torah was said to be the body of the law, the Mishnah, the soul of the law, the Kabbalah, the spirit of the law. These three parts of knowledge were matters of interpretation. And there can be no doubt that the intention was to imply, as in all ancient secret orders, that those who attained to the highest degree of these orders attained to some practical achievement. They were not merely individuals who could read a little better or could argue a little more adroitly. The entire purpose of initiation into secret orders was always the same, namely the attainment of an increase of consciousness, a deeper insight into life and its mysteries, an insight that could only be strengthened by some kind of meditational discipline. Here we come to a common fact, which we know today as well as any other nation could have known it, namely that the development of the internal is always a scientific process. It is always a matter of gradually cultivating values. It can only come through one mastering step by step the disciplines of meditation and realization. Consequently, if these old mysteries had any meaning at all, they must have meant a formula, a rite, a process, a procedure for soul cultivation. A procedure that was formal and not incidental, not merely part of the be goodness which was given to the people, but a part of a be betterness that was reserved for a few, and by that few was held to be sacred and not to be communicated to any who had not passed through certain probationships and certain earlier developments. This concept was gradually incorporated into the structure of Jewish religion, although the details are not always available. We know that in the tabernacle in the wilderness, the three parts or rooms were clearly indicated: the courtyard for the gathering of the peoples, the holy place for the gathering and communion of the priests, the Holy of Holies, the sanctuary in which only the high priest of Israel himself might enter, and only after he had removed the garments of glory and had entered into the presence of the Lord, who dwelt between the wings of the angels or cherubs upon the mercy seat, and was present in the form of the mysterious Merkava again, the mysterious presence or power of deity. In this sense, therefore, the ark was the Merkava, for in it the angelic power united with earth in the proving of the mystery of life. When the temple of Solomon the king was built upon the rocky crest of Moriah, there was placed upon the doors of the everlasting house figures of cherubs, guardians holding the flaming swords. And these were the keepers of the sanctuary. And only when Solomon called upon the name of his father David did the Lord open the doors of the sanctuary of Israel. These cherubs guarding the ancient way certainly represented some power guarding something of meaning, import, or significance. The very way of the temple itself was the way of personal growth and development. Maimonides tells us something of this, but not too clearly, because he was bound very closely by the orthodoxies of his faith. But he does assure us of the meditational disciplines of his people. He does assure us that these people practiced spiritual arts, that they sought their Father in prayer and quietude, that they performed not only the common rituals of their faith, but if they were devout, they retired into their closets and there besought in secret the mystery of heaven and the intercession of the divine powers. And in their experiences of this kind, they explored the universe.